This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio. Today I'm talking with Adam Mansbach. He's the author of two novels, Shackling Water and most recently, Angry Black White Boy, or The Miscegenation of Macon Détourné. He's also the author of a book of poems called Genius B-Boy Cynics, Getting Weeded in the Garden of Delights. And he's the founding editor of the hip-hop journal Elementary. Adam Mansbach, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you.
Tell me about this latest work, Angry Black White Boy. Why did you decide to write it?
I decided to write Angry Black White Boy really because I feel that the dialogue on race and on white privilege in this country has stalled. And this was my attempt to jumpstart it. The book is a satire that deals with race, with whiteness, and with hip-hop. It's the story of an Afrocentric white kid named Macon who grows up kind of entranced and politicized by hip-hop culture and music in the late 80s, at a time when the music is very political. And he develops kind of a critique of whiteness based on this music and on the ways that it opens his eyes. And by the time he moves to New York City to attend college, his rage toward the sort of complacency and hypocrisy that he sees in his white community kind of boils over, and he begins robbing white people in his cab.
He's kind of the mad white avenger.
Yeah, in some ways, he kind of is. This leads to a certain kind of infamy because he's not caught for a couple of weeks. People can't connect his color with what he's doing, i.e. they can't figure out that a white person would be committing these racially motivated crimes against whites.
All the victims, they think he's black.
Right. So for a little while, New York is thrown into this strange kind of panic. White people won't take cabs. Black people can finally get cabs because nobody white wants them, so they're stopping. White people start carpooling to work. It's kind of like the Montgomery bus boycott on acid. And he eventually gets caught and emerges from jail the next day, is bailed out the next day, and finds himself kind of infamous and uses this platform that he suddenly has to talk about race, to sort of tell the white man in the mirror the truth right to his face, as he puts it, and ends up calling for a national day of apology based on a statement in Malcolm X's autobiography, in which Malcolm says, rhetorically, of course, that white people should walk up to black people on the street and apologize. Macon is like, okay, let's do it on Friday. So people flood New York City from all over the country to participate in this kind of ill-considered, well-intentioned, and ultimately disastrous day of apology. New York City ends up igniting into kind of an epic race riot based on the sort of what this apology doesn't contain, which is enough understanding, enough sincerity. It sort of allows white people to continue to be in control of the conversation. It just doesn't go well. And Macon is left to try to confront what he's created, and is sort of unable to do so, ends up fleeing New York City on a bus headed down south, which turns out not to be the best idea he ever had.
When did you become aware of this issue of whiteness?
For me, it was at a young age, and like Macon, I was largely awakened to it through hip-hop. Hip-hop at that time was the thing that seemed to me to be most profoundly critiquing the dominant culture. Around 1988, when I was 12, I began to listen to groups like Public Enemy, Boogie Down Productions, X-Clan, Brand Nubian, groups that really had a political agenda. And at that time, you know, hip-hop really seemed to be coalescing into a movement. So I don't know. I think my consciousness of these things on some kind of subconscious level predated my listening to that music. But that music really gave voice to it and drew me in a way through the politics and the poetry of it.
Were your parents, for instance, active in the civil rights movement or left-wingers? Or did you get some of that from them?
Yeah, certainly. My parents are certainly left-wingers. My dad is a journalist, so you know, at that time, listening to hip-hop, you had to do sort of secondary research. Chuck D would talk about Eldridge Cleaver. And for me, finding out who that was not any more difficult than going to my dad's bookshelf, and Cleaver was there next to Alinsky and Diddy and Tom Wolfe. And I also have a grandmother who was a poet, and a very political one, actually. She had a poetry column syndicated in a bunch of newspapers, and it was called The Muse of the Week in Review. And she would take on current events and satirize whatever was happening in the news. One of her most famous pieces was a takeoff on proof rock called The Love Song of R. Milhouse Nixon around Watergate. You know, do I dare them to impeach? That kind of thing. So I think from a young age, I had a notion that words and power were connected and that you could be colorful and critical with language.
And the narrator says that Macon Detournay was fascinated with the language of hip-hop. Mm. There's this nice little riff about an Ivy League education and how stuffy the study of English is there. Mm-hmm. I think Pride and Prejudice is one of the books being assigned at Columbia. Did you go to Columbia?
I did. Okay. I did.
And your the hero goes in and doesn't want to really listen to the stuffy stuff, knows that there's a lot of lively wordplay, very yeah. inventive and creative going on. Do you still see that going on in hip-hop?
To a certain extent, yes. I think one of the things that I'm least critical about in hip-hop at this point, even as it in some ways devolves in a mainstream sense into a lot of misogyny, a lot of materialism that I'm really lamenting, the wordplay continues to be quite dazzling in a lot of ways. And I think that, you know, Macon's critique of the stuffiness is part and parcel with his critique of white privilege in general.
How so?
Well, he's critical of a canon which privileges, you know, dead white males. I mean, it's nothing particularly revolutionary or new. It's just that for him, he juxtaposes that with the liveliness of and the aliveness, really, of what he sees in the music. And it's funny because even by the time he makes that critique, he himself is already nostalgic for what the music was 10 years earlier. He's 19, but he's already sort of backward looking at a time when hip hop was intrinsically linked to political activism.
You also say that hip hop is a doorway for white America to get in touch with a culture that they're not experiencing and they ought to know about and ought to be sympathetic to. But you also go back and forth on that because you say now hip hop probably reinforces more stereotypes than it breaks, or you have him say that. Where do you come down on that one?
Well, I think that what needs to be remembered crucially about hip-hop and what I look to for inspiration and what I try to impart to young people when I'm in schools and so forth is that hip-hop is a culture that fundamentally and originally is based in poetic and artistic responses to oppression and to marginalization. And it's gone a long way away from that in some sense. Its intersection with the mainstream and with capitalism is so profound now that it really is America's dominant youth culture, and in some ways, the world's. But at its roots, at its inception, hip-hop was about creating community where there was none. In the aftermath of the Cross Bronx Expressway that decimated the Bronx, early DJs like Kool Herc and Grandmaster Flash threw parties in the parks because there were no community centers. They literally took back power from the city by jacking open lampposts to get electricity for their equipment. The early graffiti writers had this kind of audacious brilliance in which they took on the mass transit system and wrote their names on it because there were no art programs, there was no other forum, no canvas, you canvassed the neighborhood. So there was this kind of youthful, insurrectionist movement going on that really privileged community and privileged demarginalizing people. And I want to sort of look back to that in terms of hip-hop for inspiration. And in a lot of ways, it's depressing to me that kids today would not necessarily know to connect hip-hop to this kind of social movement. So what I try to do is, one, make people aware of that because hip-hop's history is rooted in this kind of grassroots action, and two, illustrate the ways in which the aesthetic principles that inform hip-hop, certain kinds of collage techniques, certain kinds of very democratic approaches to making music, making art, the kind of way that sampling operates is incredibly democratic in terms of taking from a wide array of sources and really creating a new context for them. Those principles and others are being kept alive in art forms that are sort of secondary to hip-hop that are coming into it now. So in other words, the next generation of great hip-hop minds and artists might not be rappers and DJs. They might be novelists. They might be nonfiction writers. They might be grassroots activists who are using hip-hop as an organizing principle. So in that sense, I think the essence of hip-hop is very much alive. It just doesn't live on mainstream radio.
I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm speaking with Adam Mansbach, the author of Angry Black White Boy. What about mainstream rap on mainstream radio right now?
Well, there's not too much to be excited about, in my opinion. I think we've reached a point where hip-hop has gotten incredibly good at replicating the sites of oppression that mainstream culture has created. In other words, rap has learned to be just as misogynistic, just as shallowly and callowly materialistic as America in general. So what we're seeing is a way in which this subculture, in a lot of ways, in this mainstream context, has been absorbed by and is manipulated by the interests of big business and people who are out to make money through exploitation. But I want to be real clear on the fact that that is just in this mainstream context, and there's still a lot of incredibly good work being done in hip-hop on an underground level, and also occasionally that will seep into the mainstream. I mean, there are artists who are doing good work and getting played on the radio.
I'm a father of a 15-year-old girl, and she listens to mainstream radio, of course, and rap, and she and her friends are singing in the back seat. And I always kind of think it's almost ludicrous because, not to use a play on words there, because, you know, their experience is so distant from the experience that's being expressed in these songs.
Yeah.
And in a sense, they're, you know, they're so phony in playing along, and yet... your assessment in the book seems to be that that's okay, that if they're stretching in any way, that's all right.
Well, I think that it's an interesting thing because there's this almost agreement within hip-hop that all of the artists are pretending that their primary fan base and audience looks like them, i.e. that the people listening to music are, you know, predominantly black, urban, and male. And that's actually not true at all. So there's this sort of tacit, unspoken agreement, because beyond maybe 500,000 or a million sales, there's no way that an artist like Ludacris, who you sort of mentioned a second ago, is going to be making the kind of money or recording the kind of sales he is if that was all he had. So there's this voyeurism that's not really voyeurism, because hip-hop is actually speaking to white America directly and pretending that it's not, pretending that the conversation is intended to be sort of within the urban community or the black community. But everybody knows that's not the case. As far as the listening in, the voyeurism, you know, I think that hip-hop used to be one of the only sites where whiteness was made visible in our culture. Whiteness is so normative that it's kind of off the radar. White people don't have to think about our privilege. We don't really consider the ways in which we kind of ride with the wind to our backs while everybody else rides into the wind.
You also have a great example in the book about that, where you say when two white people are talking about a stranger that they met, if they met a white stranger, they'll describe that person and not mention that that person was white. But mm-hmm. if they met a stranger who is African-American, within the first three words, they'll say, as a black guy.
Yeah, right. That's the illustration right there. And I've been using that publicly, too, because I hope that it's sort of non-threatening enough but true enough to kind of be undeniable and make people say, yeah, you know, that's true. I do that. And for the next week at work, maybe they consider it and whiteness gains a little bit of visibility. But it's funny because hip-hop has moved from a site where whiteness was very visible because there weren't that many white people in it. So for me as a young kid, like Macon, my character, I was always very conscious of my whiteness. And today, because hip-hop is so widely available – and there's this mediation of technology that's so profound, so that you don't have to leave your home anymore to consume hip-hop. You don't have to absent yourself from, say, your white suburban community and find it in some urban setting. There's not the same kind of consciousness or the same kind of dialogue among white people in hip-hop about what our cultural place might be, what the history of exploitation and co-option of black culture in America might be. So it's actually gotten to this point where white people in hip-hop are truly complacent, where you have white MCs angry about the racism that prevents black people from thinking they can rhyme. You know, it's really gotten kind of ludicrous. I mean, it almost satirizes itself, which makes my job in the book a little easier.
I'm speaking with Adam Mansbach, author of Angry Black White Boy, and Matt Rothschild. This is Progressive Radio. When you were first listening to hip-hop, did you yourself have to absent yourself from the white community, so-called?
Yeah, I did, simply because of geography and access. When I was growing up, there was not any kind of MTV representation of rap. There was one radio show in Boston when I was growing up, and it was on at 2 in the morning on Sundays, and I would sneak down from my bedroom to listen to it. But in order to experience a show, or really to go and buy the music on vinyl, I had to go venture into other areas. And the other thing was that the network of people that I began to meet who listened to the music did not live where I lived, did not look like me. I went to a school which was sort of integrated by the Metco program, which was the result of the busing battles in Boston in the 70s. And this was sort of a unidirectional form of integration where black kids from the city were bused out to suburban schools. And so those kids became my friends, largely because they had access to these tapes and they could tell me what was going on. And I would end up sort of taking the bus back to Boston with them after school. And that was sort of my way in.
Now, Boston is a notoriously racist place.
Yes.
And the busing that you mentioned occasioned a terrible racial animosity, especially mm-hmm. among white working class.
Right.
Where are we today as far as racism? How just beneath the surface is it, or is the society getting over some of that?
What I've been noticing and experiencing on my book tour for Angry Black White Boy is that there's a tremendous appetite to discuss these things. I think people on some level, both black and white, and, you know, Latino and Asian too, and it's unfortunate that we always end up talking in black and white terms and start to leave everybody out. Now, that's not my intention. There's an enormous appetite to discuss these things, and there's a real lack of opportunity and of language to do so. So, you know, when I set out to write the book, I really wanted to shake people up, slap them in the face, make white people in particular grapple with race in a way that was undeniable. Macon in the book compares it to people kicking heroin. You got to lock them in a room and not let them out no matter how much they scream. And what I've been noticing is that while that is important, and there is a resistance to it in large part, you know, in a lot of sectors of society, there is also a lot of goodwill. And so it's not just about jumpstarting the conversation. It's also about thinking about how to sustain that conversation. I think that there's an enormous investment in white America in thinking and acting like racism doesn't exist anymore, like you're anachronistic if you bring it up, like you should be wearing a dashiki and bell bottoms and holding an 8-track player if you dare to say publicly that race continues to cripple and divide us as a nation. And I think that what that is just a refusal to look at the ways in which white privilege continues to work for us economically, institutionally. Nobody wants to really take that on, but it's a burden on us still, on everyone.
Part of what you're doing when you're speaking around is also similar to what your central character is trying to do, Macon, in discussing whiteness and bringing whiteness to the attention, I imagine, of generally white audiences. And your character wrestles in this book with his good intentions.
Mm-hmm.
He's trying so hard to fit in, so hard to be hip or down with his black friends.
Right.
And that could be criticized, and sometimes is, by some of the other characters, especially mm-hmm. black characters in the book, as being, you know, who is this, you know, wannabe, horribly yeah. self-conscious wannabe at the
right.
beginning, too.
Right.
And yet the narrator, and by implication you, the author, praise him for his courage in doing so. It's kind of a dance, though, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, I want to be very critical of Macon. In a lot of ways, this book is almost a manual on how not to build a coalition, how not to grapple with race, because Macon is a deeply conflicted and twisted 19-year-old kid whose pathology is all about acceptance. And in a lot of ways, although we do share some geographical cultural history, he's an anti-autobiographical character. He's the guy I chose not to become, in the sense that his understanding of race is very deep. He's very committed, but it's also very narrow, and it's caught up in this need for absolution and acceptance by black people.
Which is almost pathetic as it comes to
it. In some ways it is. It's also driving him toward a certain kind of courage. And in a way, Macon is a way for me to explore the possibility of the current moment in terms of the hip-hop generation, in terms of an enormous number of white kids crossing over culturally into blackness, looking around, figuring out what it can do for them and mean to them. And in a lot of ways, I think what that is a conscious or subconscious or unconscious idea and understanding that whiteness is to be critiqued. There's something not quite okay about it. That privilege is something to grapple with, but they don't know quite how to do it. And what ends up happening is there's a very unbalanced equation, because the opposite of white privilege is not blackness. The opposite of white privilege is dismantling white privilege. So to hide culturally in blackness, or to think that you are fighting the fight just by sort of being accepted by black people, being seen as down, allows you to slip into a certain kind of very narcissistic self-indulgence that doesn't actually do anything, just like guilt doesn't do anything. White guilt is totally useless. You know, we have to figure out ways to surmount that and actually get into some action. We need to deal with a certain kind of unyielding, unflinching, constant critique of white privilege and be aware of how it operates in our lives and the ways in which racism is not just what happens, but what doesn't happen. The way that, you know, you don't have to psychologically grapple with its effects every day of your life as a white person. But we also have to get organizationally grounded and involved and actually do this work on the ground. And we also, I think, have to mitigate against the tendency that a lot of so-called down white boys have to just sort of, and girls too, to sort of disappear into communities where we're going to feel appreciated and safe, like hip communities, urban communities, racially integrated communities, you know, the Berkeleys and the Fort Greens of the world, to use two examples where I personally have lived, and actually take that consciousness about race back to the communities that most need it and sort of break up hegemony where it really exists.
You know, I'd love it if you could read a section, a couple paragraphs from your book, Angry Black White Boy, that relates directly to this question of trying to get acceptance.
Sure.
That we were just talking about. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild, and I'm speaking with the author, Adam Mansbach.
This is a section from early in the book that describes Macon at about 13 years old and the ways in which he is dealing with hip-hop and his need for acceptance. From Macon's confusion had bubbled anger. How dare black people not see him as an ally, not recognize that he was down? He retaliated by studying their history, their culture. He was a 13-year-old white boy in a Malcolm X t-shirt, alone at the first annual Boston hip-hop conference, heart fluttering with intimidation and delight as scowling, bald-headed old-schoolers pointed at his chest, demanding, "What you know about that man?" Which was exactly what he'd wanted, why he'd worn it. He ran down Malcolm's life for them, watched them revise their expressions with inward elation, nodded studiously at their government assassination theories, rhymed when the chance presented itself, tagged other graffiti writers' black books, and wondered what it would take to be scratched from the devil list for good. And yet history was overwhelming, and deep down Macon knew the truth.
That's Adam Mansbach reading from Angry Black White Boy. There's another part of this book that has nothing really directly to do anyway with the central character Macon, which is kind of interesting for those of us who are sports fans or who are interested in the history of race relations in the United States. It's the discussion of a baseball player, Moses Fleet Walker, first African-American in the major leagues, and some of the horrendous racism that he faced. You have this in italics in several sections throughout the book. Mm-hmm. What was your purpose in imposing him on the book?
I wanted to counterbalance the voice and the sort of swift acceleration of the main narrative, first of all, with another voice that was older and sort of studied in a different way, calmer and from a different time, and that's Fleet's voice. But more than that, what I wanted to do was illuminate the fact that when we deal with race in this country, we're really sort of standing on the visible tip of an iceberg, and we're fundamentally very ahistorical, so we don't really look under the water, but what lies there is the whole history and legacy of crimes committed by and against our ancestors. And I also wanted to have Macon and the other main character in the book, Andre Walker, his roommate at college, be inheritors not just of kind of a general legacy of violence in America, but a very specific familial one. So
they are direct inheritors.
Yeah, they are direct descendants. Andre Walker is Fleet Walker's grandson, great-grandson, and Macon is the great-grandson of a baseball player from the same time named Cap Anson, who was one of the men who helped to instigate segregation in Major League Baseball.
And Andre and Macon become roommates right away at Columbia.
Right. Not coincidentally either. Macon knows the history and wants them to be roommates so that he can somehow confront the sort of sins of the father. He doesn't quite know how he's going to do it, but he feels strongly that he and Andre should meet and be roommates. So I want, and also, you know, baseball is such a fascinating site, as you say, of social history. And I wanted to tap into that. You know, back then, I mean, we call it the national pastime now. It really was then. We didn't have basketball or football or hockey. It was baseball and boxing. So you can do an enormous amount of research into racial and social history just by delving into those two things. And that was something that always appealed to me. I've always been a baseball fan. I have an uncle who's a sports writer. And again, living in Boston, you know, dealing with baseball is something that is not a choice. You know, the curse was like the first abstract concept I was aware of as a child. I can't see it. I can't touch it, but it does exist.
More than God or gravity.
Oh, much more so, you know. but also, you know, the Red Sox were the last team in the majors to field a black ball player. 12 years after Jackie Robinson reintegrated baseball, they fielded Elijah Pumpsy Green in, you know, 1959. I mean, it's crazy. So
it's interesting. You know, I'm a sports fan too, more of basketball than of baseball, actually. But when I'm watching basketball or talking about basketball in a white audience, mm-hmm. or just with white friends, that is, I don't talk about it in crowds. frequently, racist comments come up, or mm-hmm. you know, all black players there. You know, yeah. there's no white guy, or you know, look at that slow white guy. He can't play ball, or
right.
things like that. So,
right.
I mean, there in instances like that, the racism can kind of bubble up.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's because people think that you know we're just watching the game and we can BS about it.
Yeah.
How much does racism infuse sports these days, do you think?
I think that it is the subtext and the most important subtext in some ways to most of the commentary that goes around, goes along with sports. I mean, Dave Shields has written a very interesting book about the kind of voyeurism that exists around basketball. The fact that all of these extremely talented, highly paid black bodies are being centralized and fetishized in some ways by an audience that is largely white is fascinating. And I think you're right. That's a way in which a lot of racial tension gets worked out. You know, the way that race surrounds, say, an incident like the Ron Artest thing in a kind of unspoken way. How would that incident have been different if Ron Artest was a white player? Larry Bird recently made some comments about how the NBA needs more white stars. And of course, there's a racialization to all of the economics and all of the ways in which education and sports come together or fail to. The graduation rates of black NCAA athletes versus white is astoundingly
exploitative.
There have been comments recently about raising the age for NBA players to be drafted, and that has all kinds of racial implications, as I believe Tracy McGrady recently made clear in some comments. And it's also interesting because we're living in an age when athletes are not expected to be political in the same way that they often were in past decades. We don't have the Jackie Robinsons, the Muhammad Ali's, the Craig Hodges anymore that we used to.
Although there are some athletes who have been protesting the Iraq War, for instance, or
yeah.
not stand or turning their back on the national anthem, or just not singing the national anthem.
Right.
And yet we don't hear their stories as much. It's as
right.
though the mainstream media, you know, will give it one day. It doesn't want us to really know or sympathize or act accordingly
yeah.
with some of these, like Steve Nash, for instance, who's a white ball player. But mm-hmm. there are other African American ball players who've also express themselves on it, and somehow the media wants to swallow that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's part and parcel with the media's general willingness to ignore protest and to pretend that it's not going on with the ferocity and the sincerity and in the numbers that it really is. I mean, that's just part of a general climate in this country. The media is not taking responsibility largely the way it should, except in avenues like this. But it's also the case, I think, that we've moved away from an era in which the only visible spokespeople, famous people who were black, were either athletes or entertainers. We've moved somewhat away from that. The visibility that athletes have is different. And also, you know, Muhammad Ali didn't have to worry about whether Nike was going to drop him from his contract for protesting the Vietnam War. You know, I mean, he's a unique example and a great man, so it's not really fair to hold everybody to his standards. But there's a way in which athletes at this point, I think, generally think about their portfolio first and their politics second. And that's not to spotlight them, because we're all kind of guilty of that. But it seems to be the case.
Unfortunately, we're out of time. I'd love to spend a little more time talking with you. Adam Mansbach, he's the author of Angry Black White Boy. Adam, thanks so much for being my guest.
Thank you.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.